recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality.
Richard Hall is taken hostage in his own mortgage company and marched down the streets of Indianapolis in 1977. As Hall slips, an excited rookie draws his gun. A seasoned veteran motions him to holster it.
Right there, what are you doing with that thing?
Yeah. Might get back.
Gunman takes a pair of police handcuffs and a patrol car. Caritzis, a bartender, is enraged at Hall for turning down his loan application.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Joe Melillo, here for 2020. So glad you made it back. Man, 2019 was a monster year for us here at Infamous Indie, mainly because it was the launch year. We actually put some content out for you. Hopefully you enjoyed it all the way back. If you remember, the first episode was with Libby German, the sister of one of the Delphi girls, unfortunately, that were murdered. That case is still unsolved. And if you know anything, please go to my website, infamousindie.com. You can click on the podcast and a little bit about the notes and resources, I call it. You click on the resources tab and you can find out more information on how you can help that investigation. Literally, you can make a difference. And that's kind of the lesson that I think that I'd like to take from 2019 from, and I hope you do, for this podcast. You know, we have the ability to make change. We have the ability to listen to somebody else's story, understand them, and be there for them. So do us all a favor in life and just be nice to people. You never know what they've been through, and it could be just someone walking down the street and they could have had something happen to them that you have no idea about. So let's be kind here in 2020 to humanity. Also coming up this episode, well, I'm sorry for being a little bit, you know, absent. The last few weeks, we all get in that holiday spirit, and this was one of the first years in my life since I, at least the first time since I left news, where the holidays was a much bigger deal for me, where I actually had some time off and could spend it with my family, go Christmas shopping, you know, do the traditional stuff. So I'm finally feel like I'm back to being a little bit more normal with a work schedule, because I don't have to wake up at 2:30 in the morning to be a reporter at Wish TV. This episode is about Wish TV. This episode is using my connections for there to talk to a man. His name is Jack Parker. Jack was a photographer for Channel 4 in Indianapolis, but also for Channel 8 in his later years. And he covered some of the major, major events here in Indianapolis. And you'll hear at the end of the podcast, in the end of the interview, him mention that we might have to get back together because there are other stories that he was intimately involved in. He's the guy at a news station that picks up the camera, puts it on his shoulder, and does the best thing he can to get he puts his best effort out to get the best video he can so that the viewers at home can see it. Back in 1977, in the Tony Caritzis case is what we're talking about today. It was February 1977, and Jack Parker was working at Channel 4. And you'll hear how he hears on the scanner about Tony Caritzis taking somebody hostage in downtown Indianapolis. It was very, very cold outside. Tony Caritzis walked to Meridian Street to a mortgage company called Meridian Mortgage. He went up the stairs and he took one of the mortgage brokers or partner's sons hostage, who was also working at the mortgage company. Tony was upset over essentially him not honoring an agreement that they had made, and it ended up screwing Tony out of a lot of money. So to get full revenge, and honestly, it was very well thought out by Tony Caritzis to not get killed by police, because if he took someone hostage and he didn't have a backup plan, he was going to get murdered by police. Murdered. He was going to get shot and stopped by police. So he ensured that his contraption was able to convince police not to shoot him. It's called a dead man's trigger. Essentially, he wrapped a wire hanger around Dick Hall's throat, had the shotgun directly behind his head. His hand was on the trigger, and connected to him was a system that if his hand fell too far away from the trigger, it actually would go off and Dick Hall would be shot and killed. So the idea is you got to keep Tony Caritzis alive. At least police believe this. You can't shoot Tony Caritzis, or else Dick Hall is going to get shot and killed. So you'll hear in the story exactly what happened, but from Jack's perspective, as he rolls up to the scene on the streets of Indianapolis, on Washington Street, like a main street in downtown Indy, and this guy is being paraded around downtown Indianapolis with a gun pointed at the back of his head. It was very tense, it was very real, but it almost felt surreal, because nobody could believe that this was actually happening, and for the first time, news had the ability to go live. And that was new technology. And so what that meant was this whole thing played out in front of an audience. In fact, it played out in front of a national audience. You'll hear Jack talk about his video, what he did to shoot it, why he won awards for it. And if you'd like to see it, you can go on and go to the Infamous Indy Podcast under the resources section and watch the video. I'll put the YouTube link there. There's also a new documentary, and this is kind of what got me onto this case. I've known about this case for a long time. I've been trying to talk to Dick Hall to see if I could get an interview with Dick Hall, or at least if you know Richard Essex from this podcast, he's a reporter at Wish, try to get Richard to interview him and then use that interview for this podcast as a kind of a little bit of a satellite help for Infamous Indy. And Dick Hall has been scarred by this event for his whole life, and he's talked about it in a new book that he released a couple years ago. He actually made his first real appearance to talk about it a couple of years ago, and that's where Richard Essex was and actually had a chance to talk to him. Unfortunately, I don't know if I'll be able to talk to him for you guys. I just don't think it's right. He's, he obviously struggles with the incident his whole life. And you'll see in the video, he was hurt. He was being bullied and pushed around a lot that day. And more importantly, for 3 days in total, the total of like something like 60 plus hours, he was held hostage. Eventually, Tony Caritzis got him off the streets, took a police car to his house on the west side, near west side, and in an apartment complex had set up a booby trap where essentially if a sniper tried to shoot him through the window, a candle would be ignited and then fall into a bucket of gasoline and explode, and they would kill everybody inside, including Dick Hall. So police didn't want to do it. It was really one of the first major hostage negotiations ever captured on film. I guess it would be film, or ever shot on tape, and then obviously captured live. You could go to, I'll put two videos up, the one of Jack Parker's actual video with the reporters voice over on it, so like you'll hear the reporter tell the story. And then we'll also look at, I'll also put online the actual press conference that he had, that Tony Karitsis had after 3 days. He came down, read a piece of paper, Dick calls on the end of his dead man's line, and God, it's so intense. There's like 100 people, including, and he was live on national TV. He would have blown his head off on national TV if he pulled the trigger. Ultimately, I think the best job ever in telling this story, and I can appreciate good work and well thought out and researched interviews and editing and music. This guy needs to win an award for it. But the documentary that I'm talking about is Dead Man's Line. Alan Berry is the director, and I was able, he's from Indianapolis. I've able to kind of communicate with him over the last couple of weeks. I'd like to try to bring him on here. So this might be a two-part episode. So let's go over first Jack Parker's interview, and then hopefully soon I will have Alan Berry here, the guy who actually got all those interviews, who talked to all these old reporters and old news directors and people who were basically two generations before me in news here in Indianapolis. It was a different world in that time, and things meant different. You know, things were taken differently, especially when it came to video and audio, and it's just incredible to look back on this video. So what an insight we have for this episode. Jack Parker is going to tell us exactly what happened that day when he first heard the scanner call of Tony Karitsis taking Dick Hall hostage in downtown Indianapolis, and then everything that played out after. I hope you enjoy the episode, and I'll see you after. Thanks. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast interview portion. The man we're about to speak to is a friend of mine. He was also a coworker of mine at Wish TV. He has since retired from Wish TV, but he's also one of the most accomplished photographers, news photographers in the country. His name is Jack Parker. Thank you so much for joining me, Jack Parker.
Sure, Joe. Glad to talk with you.
We're sitting in your office, in your hobby room. You have a lot of hobbies, including CB radio and some other gadgets. But more importantly, you know, you're just a guy that is very detail oriented, especially from what your wife tells me right there.
That's right.
What's the best part about that for my listeners is that you're going to be able to bring us back to the day in February 1977 when Tony Karitsis took Dick Hall into his hands, essentially, and took him hostage, paraded him downtown Indianapolis, got into a police car, and then drove to his apartment complex where the two-day saga unfolded in front of the nation. It was a national story, yep. And it changed the way our industry is, and the news industry, as well as police tactics on handling hostage situations, because it was unlike anything. And it, guys, when you see this video, I'm going to put it on infamousindie.com. It's also on YouTube. You can just go to YouTube and check it out. If you see most of the footage without the reporter's voice, then that is Jack Parker's video. And I'll be able to post it for you and get it on. But Jack, I am honored. And, you know, phones go off during interviews, so don't okay. he muted it. But I'm so honored, and you live literally right down the street from me.
Yeah, I had no idea that you were that close.
So. Well, I'm so honored that you'd be here to talk to me today, and let's get into it. More importantly, let's go over kind of the change of the industry and news industry for our listeners, because a lot of people assume how news is, and it's different today than it ever was when you were doing it. But tell me a little bit about that day. You were a photographer for how long?
At that point, 7 years. You were at Channel 4. I was the chief photographer. And I actually was in early that morning to write some thank you letters, because I was also president of the Indiana News Photographers Association. And we'd had our statewide convention that weekend. And I'm sitting there writing thank you letters on a typewriter. And we heard a report of a man with a gun downtown.
Because then you only had scanners. There weren't like tweets or any of that stuff, right?
No, yeah. And the police only had two channels at that time, so it was fairly easy to follow that. And then a few seconds later, we heard a man with a gun holding another man, and then that evolved into a man with a gun with the, holding a police officer. Well, by that time, we were out the door, and I say we, my reporter, Jeannie Raymond, who was fairly new as a reporter. She'd been newsroom secretary for some time, but we'd kind of were working her out to be a reporter. Well, this turned out to be the biggest story that she ever covered. And so Jeannie jumped in the news car with me, and we raced from Sumner Road and Bluff Road, where the station was, uptown. The advantage I had when we got there was this came down on Ohio Street.
129 East Market.
That's where East Market, yes.
Well, that's where the that's where Dick Hall's mortgage company was.
Right.
And that's where Tony Caritsis went and into and what's crazy is that he went into the building and then called police to say, I have a dead man's trigger on this guy's head, essentially, you know, pointed at this guy's head. So if some crazy person tries to stop me, it's going to kill me. And it's going to kill Dick Hall. So I'm calling you to let you know this is happening. Yeah. And then I'm going to walk him out. So it started on 129 East Market and went east for a block.
West.
Oh, I'm sorry. West for a block.
Pennsylvania.
Towards the circle. And then he took a left on Pennsylvania.
Yeah, he wanted to try to get to the parking garage, Penn Parking at the time, to get his car to take him wherever. And where I picked him up was the police stopped him from getting into his car in Pennsylvania. So they came back out of there. Went down another half block to Washington Street, started west on Washington Street, and stopped mid-block in front of Richmond Brothers, which was a clothing store at the time on the north side of Washington Street. That's where I come in. I arrived and came up Meridian Street. Of course, I've got the police radio, so I'm hearing all the action as it's sort of playing out at that point. And
do you remember what they were saying on the radio and like... what your thought was when you were listening to it?
It was, they were trying to get control at that point. They never had a situation like this, which was just kind of blowing everybody away. They were flying by the seat of their pants. And so when I arrived, I got out of the car, I grabbed my camera, and I told Jeannie, the reporter, I said, grab an extra film magazine, because with film, you only had 11 and a half minutes total. So you had to be somewhat judicious at that point in life. Now today with videotape, you could roll as long as you want to. Almost.
Yeah. Not even tape, digital gigabytes. You know, you just spray, as we call it.
And so I worked my way next to the building. And this is where the old Merchants Bank headquarters was at Meridian, Washington. There were a few people on the street with me, on my side of the street. Across the street in the dark shadows was Tony and Dick Hall. Half a block back were police officers and the rest of the media. At that point, police officers going to the west were going down the street because it was 9:25 in the morning when I got there. They were literally pushing people into the storefronts that had just opened up saying, lock your door, don't come out. And they went down the street. So with all that going on, nobody paid any attention to me. I started off shooting. I went mid-block across from them and then kind of eased my way out to the edge of the street and used the light pole as a tripod to steady up my picture, shooting 40 yards across six lanes, empty lanes at that time, of Washington Street. All traffic had been stopped. And we... they were there for just a couple minutes, and then Tony decided to start taking his walk west.
One of the most iconic shots that you got from this situation, again, folks, remind you, 1977 film, the audio isn't all that the best. It's not sound off your top. You're not going to have a microphone or a boom mic with somebody. Not as nice as this one that we're using today.
Oh, no, nothing like this.
But you were able to pick up some of the audio, and this is incredible stuff. You were able to actually catch him in this moment of panic, almost, for police, for everyone watching, where he falls, where Tony Caritsis falls from the ice, because it's February in Indianapolis, and it's freezing. It's 9 degrees outside.
Right.
And they... not only does he fall, but then you realize at that moment that he has another gun in his waistband, and he almost loses it as he goes to draw it. And police, and this shot that is unbelievable that you got, where police officers are in between Tony Caritzis and you, mm-hmm. and the one police officer is a younger guy, and he goes to pull his gun on Tony, and the older police officer tells him, no, holster your gun, just wait.
Yeah.
And he did. But it was a perfect example, a microcosm of all the tension that was going on. So congrats to you on that, man. Way to get that shot.
You know, 7 years of being in the media, I look at it as all training up to that point, mm-hmm. and just catching it and everything. My first thought when I got out of the car and went to the light pole and started shooting is the very popular TV show had Telly Savalas on it at that time, which had crime scenes kind of like that. And I thought, I'm looking through my viewfinder, which is a black and white viewfinder, and I'm thinking, am I watching Tony Savalas, his show? And I can't remember the name of the show right now, but it was so surreal. Nobody had ever seen anything like that in real life.
Right. And Tony at that point was so erratic. Did he ever turn to you at one point and say anything to you, to the cameras, to you, to any, but you were able to hear everything he was saying?
Yeah. Yeah. And my original audio came out fairly well, that exchange when Tony's yelling at the police officers there at Illinois Street, but also the sergeant and the patrolman, when he say, no, holster. And I had all that on tape or on film.
On film. Yeah. Yeah. We can't say tape. We got to say film. Yeah. And it's funny because nobody says film anymore. We just say shoot video.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So as you're continuing going west, you know, you're following, you catch the slip, you catch that moment with those two police officers, and then it continues to go west. And we can walk the streets. I'm actually heading downtown today, and we're going to be able to walk the streets where Tony Caritzis did this. And then, at that point, police officers usually, like you said, tell me about that, the next stop, because you also caught something that actually helped you win an award for the video.
Right. Yeah. Well, they continued west across Illinois Street, past the State House. When they get to Senate Street, which was an open street at that time, there was no Westin Hotel or anything. And at that intersection, they noticed that there was a police car who had parked just north of the intersection. And that officer was kind of controlling traffic, but he left the car running and he left the door open. And when they get to that point, Tony sees this nice warm car. It's 9 above 0. They're in their shirt sleeves. And he's thinking, we got a long walk. So to the west side. Of course, we had no idea where they were headed with this.
Or Tony, because Tony had tried to get his car, but he had forgotten where he parked it.
Right.
Which is hilarious, but also an actual a fact that you wouldn't realize.
Right. So he commandeers the police car.
Yep.
As they were getting to the police car to pull him in, I hear this screech of tires. And at that point, if you look carefully at the video, you see the tension in Tony's eyes and Dick Hall's eyes. It just sort of releases like, oh, what's that? And I spun around and got this car who got caught up in the action and hit a light pole on the south side of the street.
Somebody was gawking.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, we've had gawkers for a long time. And so it kind of broke the tension of the moment. And later on, a year later, when my film was reviewed in a national contest, one of the judges came up and complimented me on that. He says, one thing that sold me on your piece was at that moment, you waited just that moment. You saw their eyes change, and then you spun around to get the reaction. So he was impressed by the situational awareness. I don't know if I was that aware or just normal reaction. Then I spun back around, because we're only talking like a couple of seconds. And at that point, then Tony was going into the car and pulling Dick Hall in behind him. And he made Dick Hall drive out to the west side. Now, we had no idea where they were going at the time. As soon as they left with the red lights on, not with a siren at the time, but as soon as they left the scene, it was total chaos. And literally, my colleagues in the media were commandeered. One of those was Dick Baldwin from Channel 6. Dick was there. He changed film magazines real quick. And he commandeered a bread truck and said, follow that car.
You would never be able to get away with that today, but no. That is incredible.
Yeah.
And not to mention, he got to eat along the way. He brought some snacks for everyone.
Right. So I ran back to Meridian and Washington Street, where I left my car, leaving my reporter, Janie Raymond, there with the tripod and with my extra film magazine. And I'm kind of running through traffic across Washington Street. And when I get there to the car, I had been followed by Doug O'Brien from WIBC News, Dave Manweiler from the Indianapolis News, the newspaper, and Cheryl Miller from Wire Radio at the time.
It was a country station, right?
Country station, yeah. And to this day, Cheryl doesn't like me because the Maverick news car was pretty small for a news car. I had a small platform in the back seat behind the driver's side where I would set my camera so to drive rather than put it in the trunk.
The trunk, yeah.
So I said, hey, I still got a reporter with equipment I got to pick up down at the State House. So I looked, and I knew Doug, and I kind of knew Dave Bandwater. Didn't know Cheryl that well, so I said, Cheryl, you're going to have to find another way to go. So to this day, she goes, you left me standing at Meridian and Washington Street. Sorry. We're racing, we thought they were going out to the airport to commandeer an airplane, because this was in the day and age of it was popular to hijack an airplane. And so as we're headed out the interstate, Dave Manweiler is in the passenger seat next to the scanner. Doug O'Brien is in the back seat on the passenger side with his two-way radio, handheld radio, talking with WIBC, which wasn't working real well with them at that point. And Jeannie Raymond was sitting behind me. I was the only one in town at that point that had the very first mobile phone. You had to go through the mobile phone operator. So Jeannie is on the phone talking with the newsroom on the mobile phone to give them an update of what we're doing. And it was just kind of crazy because she's trying to talk. Doug O'Brien's trying to talk to the radio station. And Dave Manweiler's going, shh, hey, I'm trying to listen to the scanner. Just keep driving.
Yeah, just go. But again, you didn't know where they were going.
No.
So you're going on the inclination that maybe they're going to head to the airport. So let's start heading that way.
Right.
And then you hear the scanner and it changes everything.
Right. Yeah. At some point before we get to 465 off of Raymond Street, mm-hmm. Dave said they're going to this girls' school in Rockville Road. Mm-hmm. It's an apartment complex. We go, okay, so that was good timing because I was able to jump back on 465, go up to Rockville Road, get off there, and by the time we got to the apartment, we basically got there at the same time with the police because they, again, were just sort of responding. And what made this interesting was this was outside of the old Indianapolis Police Department city limits. So it started in their jurisdiction, but went over into the county jurisdiction, basically before we got that far. So we had a full configuration of people there trying to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
And not to mention, it became either Marion County, right? Was because that wasn't Marion County Sheriff's Department. Wasn't that it's their jurisdiction?
Right.
Yeah. And
right.
Then it also, obviously, state police were going to be involved.
Yeah.
So they showed up.
Right. And
you show up to this apartment complex. What were you thinking this guy's doing? What are you talking? Because, when I'm a reporter and Marcus Collins and I are at a scene, we're obviously speculating and trying to figure out what's in this guy's head and what we know about this. And what was your first thought about Tony Caritsas and this apartment complex and everything?
We were just trying to put it together. At the same time, they're telling us to stay back because they've been told he has explosives. Well, also, I look to my right, and the nearest, all at Crestwood Village West, they have like each building has a central area to it, and then four wings to it, and three floors. They were on the third floor. I look off to the west, and they are evacuating the building we're in, out the backside, and also the building adjacent to it, in case it blew up. And what was interesting was, this is in February, it's 9 degrees above zero, and all these little old people that they're escorting out, they're just as happy as could be because this is real exciting stuff. And so as we, things become sort of normalized where we knew we were going to be there for a while, we went into the adjacent building so we could see Tony's window. And here they were worried about it blowing up. But the media, these little people said, well, the apartment's over or open. You can go in, and there's food in the refrigerator if you need anything to drink.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they just basically opened up their homes on the first floor and let us move in for the next 2 or 3 days.
You know what's funny is that the way you speak about that, that happens to us as well. What you guys are listening to, and my infamous indie listeners are here hearing, is two different generations of TV reporters. And photographers. I am a photographer because that's what an MMJ is. I'm all encompassing. I do everything, or I did everything. And you are, so it's an honor to be able to sit across from you as two generations, especially of Wish TV photographers and reporters.
Sure.
But also your experience and your knowledge. But that exact thing happened to me too. I would be at a scene, or it would be a hostage situation, and someone would say, "Hey, you want some coffee? Or do you, here's a donut for you." Or here, yeah. You know, they'll go out and get us stuff. And it was so nice that the public would be so nice in those situations.
Yeah, Hoosiers are...
Yeah, that's true. It is more Hoosier than
anything. Yeah. They're wonderful people. And, you know, even in all this craziness, they still look out and they say, "You're sort of normal. You want coffee? Yeah. I'll get some coffee."
Well, that's what you offered me when I came in today.
Yeah, sure.
You're in this apartment. You actually were in an apartment across the way.
Yes.
Okay. Could you get any footage of Tony in the apartment while he was there? Because remember, or why don't you remind people what was going on in that apartment? What he had claimed to be going on in that apartment?
Tony claimed that the patio window that we were looking at and his door were both wired. In that they were wired to explosives. So if they tried to shoot through the windows or tried to bust in with the SWAT team, all along he was very concerned about the SWAT team. And back then, we didn't have much of a SWAT team. It was just very loosely organized at the time. That, again, was one of those changes that came because of that incident. It ramped things up for Indianapolis and for the Sheriff's Department about, oh, gosh, we need to have a more formal SWAT team training and everything else. So that changed things amongst those two agencies, at least. But we're looking at it, and occasionally we would go out, and I wasn't rolling the whole time, but I had my finger on the start button on the film camera. Again, with the film camera, I only had a total of 11 and a half minutes before I had to change magazines, reload the film camera, and then I could go another 11 and a half minutes. Everybody basically was in the same boat at the time. But we kept an eye on that, and we would occasionally step out, which was on the doorway from our building, overlooking Tony, and things had calmed down within an hour or two as things were kind of settling in a little bit.
So more around noon, you know, things are settling in around noon that first day.
Right. And they were hoping to resolve this thing within a couple hours.
Right, of course. Well, why wouldn't you think that?
Yeah. Well, it was 63 hours later.
Yeah. So how, you spent a lot of that time in that apartment, or did you get called somewhere else?
No.
Or?
No, I basically was out there for 3 days. Usually by about 7 or 8 o'clock at night, the news director would call and say, okay, it doesn't look like anything's happening. Go ahead and go home, get something to eat, and get back out there at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. So, and this was kind of in the day, the news cycle was basically from late evening to early morning. Vice versa. You didn't have to worry about that.
Right, right. Once late evening was over, go home. You know, we ain't got a show till tomorrow anyway. So
I spent 3 days out there, and
the second day comes around. So you go in the morning.
Right. And I'm there all day. And okay, now we're getting into overtime. So about 6 o'clock that night, we're kind of analyzing this whole thing, and the news director calls and said, look, doesn't sound like anything's going to be resolved today. Go home, have a good meal.
That's the second day, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go home and have a good meal. And I said, okay. So I'm sitting there. I just eaten. I took a shower. I'm sitting there in my bathrobe watching TV, and all of a sudden up on Channel 8 pops up this live picture from inside, and it's a news conference. And I go, oh, crap.
And it turns out to be one of the most famous news conferences of all time. You know, honestly, no credit to Tony for doing something like that. But at the time, they didn't know what to do other than to give him the opportunity so that maybe it would calm him down and maybe they would allow him, the police to get the gun away from Dick Hall.
Right. Now, they had been negotiating with him for 63 hours on all this. There was a couple of police, I think they even brought in an FBI negotiator. They had more experience with this sort of thing. But the guy that was actually the intermediary for all that was Fred Heckman, who was news director at WIBC. Tony liked Fred Heckman and only trusted Fred Heckman. He didn't trust the cops. So he says, I'm only talking to Fred Heckman. And
Did you ever meet Fred Heckman? Did you know Fred Heckman?
Yeah, I almost went to work for WIBC, even auditioned there for a slot while I was still at the Fort Harrison in the service, which is what brought me to Indianapolis in the first place. So, yeah, I was very familiar with Fred and then seen him a couple of times.
And what kind of guy was he?
He was the dean of newsmen in Indianapolis, a straight shooter, highest principles that you could demand. And what was interesting, and I didn't know this until a couple of years ago, that Tom Cochran was on the air that morning when all this came down. Tom was a fairly new reporter right out of IU, and Tom actually got the job that I had auditioned for at WIBC. But after that, I thought they actually got the best guy. Tom was extremely talented, and he was on the air. And when Fred became the intermediary, they basically said, Fred, you're no longer welcome in the newsroom because you're part of the story.
Wow.
So they made Fred sit outside, had nothing to do with the news department for the next few days because he was the intermediary. Mm-hmm. The other thing I learned, which was sort of the first lesson, was Ken Martz was the prosecutor, deputy prosecutor at the time. He was handling the negotiations when Tony would talk to them, again, through Fred.
And Fred, just for clarification, would call Tony on the phone.
Yeah.
So the deputy prosecutor would ask Fred to do it for him because he was the only one that was getting any response from Tony. So Fred would call because Tony would talk to him. That's basically why he became the negotiator.
Right. And we would have a news conference or an update, and Martz would say, no, look, we're telling him, if you give him up, we're not going to hold you responsibility. Just give the hostage up. Don't hurt him or anything. You've hurt him enough, and everything will be okay. So we go, oh, okay. Well, we didn't know. After Tony finally gives himself up, they take the gun away. They put him in handcuffs. Then they say, Tony, everything we told you no longer exists because we were doing that under duress.
That's right. And it's a great lesson, again, for the law enforcement community as well as the media community, that resolution is more important than anything else. Yeah, we'll tell you we're going to give you whatever you want because we're under duress to save a life.
Right.
So therefore, we don't really have to uphold what we said, because when we all look back on it now, a week later, you definitely did something wrong, Tony. Yeah.
And you have to pay for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for me and a lot of other reporters, that was a real legal lesson, how they would accomplish that.
Well, I think it's also almost like set the precedent for anybody else who even thought about doing something like that. Like, you know, you can ask for immunity, but you ain't going to get it if you do something wrong.
Right, but they don't want the suspects to know that.
Yeah. Well, they didn't. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And again, this was a whole new ball game. So they were basically flying by the seat of their pants. And I ran into a couple of police officers later on that had just come out of hostage negotiating school, which they'd never had before. And they'd only been out for a couple of weeks, and they were disappointed when I talked to them, you know, a year or so later, saying, yeah, it really made me mad because he wouldn't talk to me. How can you negotiate if he won't talk to you?
And you know what's funny? If you watch the video, folks, you'll see a guy in a yellow or orange sweater throwing his hands up. That is the negotiator. What's his name again?
John Grabo.
John Grabo. And Jack, you met John Grabo at randomly at a store, and this shows you how small Indianapolis is for a big city. You met him at a store, and you guys got talking, and sure enough, you were like, hey, I was right behind you shooting video of you trying to negotiate with Tony Caritzis.
Yeah, and I think it was in the first year. Yeah, it was in the first year. We had not gone to trial yet. And so, I met John at the sailboat shop on the south side at the time. And we sort of became casual friends at that point because I had a similar interest, but we had not gotten to the trial yet. And then when he found out that my film was Exhibit A in the trial, and I was the first witness on the stand, just to verify, the question was, is this a fair and accurate representation of what you shot? I said, oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
And now what they showed is...
Go ahead.
Was I had about 25 or 30 minutes of actual film that was put onto a videotape that was then subpoenaed by the court. So that's what was shown.
I wonder where that tape is. I wonder if that tape still has all... Because that raw footage is pretty...
You know, that's a good question. I don't know.
Maybe the Marion County Prosecutor's Office has it, you know?
Yeah, they
or at least there's an archive.
But
let's just... I just want to make sure we reiterate the fact that a photographer for a news station was the first witness on the stand for the trial, and it was you.
Right. And in the briefing with the prosecutor's office to be a witness, we kind of went over... step by step what happened, and they alluded to my film, and they said, you could not have shot better evidence for us, because just the location, you can tell by the stores where it was on Washington Street. At some point, I got people on my side of the street, on the south side of the street, that were reacting to it. Okay, for me, that's a cutaway. You know, it's a break between the main action. And then I shot the other way, and there was the cherub at the corner of Meridian and Washington Street on L.S. Ayers. And the cherub was there. That's a landmark. It had the time and a temperature.
Huh.
And so you've got it all. You got time, temperature, you set the location, and they said...
And then people's reactions.
Right.
And so... After the trial, obviously you played your part in the trial where you're sitting on the stand, but then eventually it was taken care of. He pleaded insanity. The jury unanimously said he's not guilty. In fact, because of reason of insanity, which is a 0.85% chance now that if you plead insanity, that it would actually work in today's terms.
Right. That the legislature changed that because of this incident, where basically they'd never had anybody plead and get off by reason of insanity. So now Judge Dugan said, okay, you've gotten this far. The jury has determined that you're not guilty by reason of insanity. So it comes back into me. So I'm going to order you for a psychiatric evaluation for us to determine what do you do, because they said you're insane. Your attorney got you off. You're insane. Tony says, I'm not going to do it. Judge says, no, I order you to have the evaluation. Tony says, I'm not going to do it. Then judge slams down the gavel and says, I find you in contempt of court. He stayed in mental institutions for about 10 years in contempt of court. He never went for the evaluation. And after about, it was eight or 10 years. I forget the exact amount.
I think it was 10.
Okay. Yeah. His attorney and the former deputy prosecutors all came together and said, look, Tony's not really stupid, okay? He got off by reason of insanity, but he has spent more time behind closed doors, locked doors, than he would have if they found him guilty of hostage taking. So they all got together and brought him back into court, and the judge says, you've served more than your time. I'm going to suspend the... contempt of court, mm-hmm. You're free to go. He fought it all the way. He didn't want to be back in court. And quite frankly, the last time that he had moved from one place to another, mental institutions, Tony was just smart enough, but he caused problems in the mental institutions from what we were told, and that's why they wanted to get him out. And the last place was Central State, which was a a large complex on the near west side.
I got married there, Jack.
Did you?
Yeah. Me and my wife got married 2 years ago in the Central State Hospital's cafeteria that they've remade. And it's beautiful. It's called 1899.
Yeah.
But, yeah, funny story. Carrie and I got married where Tony Caritas was being held. Wow. Isn't that funny?
It drives you crazy.
I know. So, maybe it was crazy. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, honey. Yeah. So, unbelievable story. Unbelievable. I just want to make sure that people understand where your film then went. Because, yes, it was used in the trial, and it was very, very informative for the trial, but then it lived on past the trial.
Yeah, what I didn't know until like a year or so later is that because the Marion County prosecutor had it, the Indianapolis Police Department, since they were ramping up their hostage negotiating school, asked for a copy of that. And I don't know how long I've been told by different sources in recent years that they still use it occasionally as part of the training. What I do know is that the FBI asked for a copy of it, and it's still used to this day at Quantico in training because it's the only real action as it's happening, hostages negotiating or lack thereof. How do you handle a situation like this when the guy won't talk to you? And so, with that pleasure.
Have you ever met anybody who said they saw your footage later at Quantico?
Yeah. In fact,
I didn't think you were going to say yes. That's unbelievable. Okay.
Yeah. Well, one of those was Doug Garrison. Doug was a PIO for the public information officer for the Indianapolis office for a while. And part of his, what he did, they had a negotiating school for about a week being held up in Carmel, and he asked me and Bob Donaldson from Channel 59, Vince Edwards from Channel 6, and I think it was Doug O'Brien from WIBC. Doug and I were the only two that were involved in that incident, but what they wanted was a panel of, you've got these guys that have been in negotiating school. The other thing they have to realize is they're going to have to, at some point, maybe negotiate with the media. Because we're going to be standing there saying, what's going on? And so I was on a panel, and the amazing thing was I didn't think it was that big of a deal. Okay, but Doug invited me, and I said, I was the only photographer. The rest of them were like news reporters or news anchors.
Anchors, yeah.
Yeah, and I said Doug O'Brien. Actually, now that I think about it, it was Jack Martin, okay, who was like the police reporter for Channel 13.
Okay.
So I represented, at that time, I was with Channel 8, so it was 8, 6, 13. And I was honored to be on the panel, but I thought, nobody will be asking me a question because we've got these anchors and reporters that everybody knows better. And as Doug Garrison was going down, he introduced Jack Martin from 13, Bob Donaldson from 59, and Bob was a fairly new anchor at 59 at that time, and then Vince Edwards from Channel 6. And, everybody's calling the audience is sitting out there, and this was a room full of police officers that were taking this course from all over the state of Indiana. And then he gets to me, and it says, and his final line was, Jack was the photographer that shot the Tony Caritas incident and was a witness to it. And as soon as they said Jack was, Tony Caritas, you could see everybody's eyes just kind of lit up like, oh, you're the guy. Because I didn't know that at the time that they had used that in this week-long school
had. Got it. And they were like, oh, man, this guy.
Yeah.
We got it. So did you get a lot of questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
Almost all of them came to me.
Yes.
It was like, next thing I know, like they put me on a pedestal, and the other guys, I'm thinking, don't you want to ask them a question?
And it's probably a lot of the questions that I talked to. Or what was maybe, do you remember one of the questions that was more interesting, or any of the questions, really?
No, I can't remember anything.
But it was more police speak stuff, like stuff that they really needed to know as police officers.
Right. And I think some of it related to was the environment of being out of control on the street. If I saw anything that they could do different. And I don't know. You know, I wasn't thinking about that at the time.
I guess if there's one way to learn about hostage negotiating, it's in Indianapolis, Indiana, where people would be more apt to be like just watchers and not get involved, as opposed to maybe New York, right. LA, or Texas or something, where people are going to try to, hey, I'm going to do something to save this person. You know what I mean?
Right.
Not that people in Indy wouldn't do that, but just in general, maybe it was. It's also just a weird situation to walk into. On all fronts, from everybody's perspective, it was just like this one guy decided, this mortgage lender didn't give him what he wanted,
right.
Insulted him. And, you know, later on, people found out that actually Tony had been denied on a couple of different business propositions.
Yeah, so he had some basis. That came out in the trial, that actually Tony had some basis to be irate. He just took the wrong way to remedy the situation.
Wow.
The other thing was that he took Dick Hall. Well, his dad was actually president of Meridian Mortgage Company. Mm-hmm. And he's normally there at 7 o'clock, 6:30, 7 o'clock every morning. That particular day, he had another errand he had to do. So when Tony got there, it was Dick Hall and not Richard Hall,
senior. Yeah.
He wasn't there yet, so he wound up taking Dick. Well, Dick was 40 at the time, because part of his bio was he was 40, he was part of the business, he was also a private pilot, which made him cool, calm, collected, and if they'd taken his dad, who was 20-some years older, that the guy may have had a heart attack or some other health issue during the situation. So, again, just one of those points in time, luck, circumstances, but it kind of led to a safe resolution of the whole thing. The other thing that a lot of people didn't think about was after he held him for 3 days, it was 63 hours total. I wasn't there when he defined it, just kind of out. He kind of came walking out of the building with him, came walking over to the media center, which threw everybody into a tizzy. Well, by that time, all the local news stations, except for Channel 4, they all had a live camera. Now, we're talking 1967.
77.
Or 77, thank you. In February 1977, we only had thoughts of maybe having mini cams at that point. Mm-hmm. Nobody had a live truck that I know of, a microwave truck, but they did have a portable microwave for other production things. So basically everybody was setting up a portable microwave to get their signal back to the station. But this took some engineering at that time, over a couple of days to get that done.
Wasn't that press conference you were watching in your robe after your shower? Wasn't that live?
That was live.
So they did have live footage then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they had, and the cameras they had were like 70-pound studio cameras on a big tripod, just like everybody kind of took a camera out of their studio and put it out there just in case. So, yeah, so when he walked in, it came up live.
So just to be, what I want to do is, this is a great transition for my listeners to, let's go into a little bit about what it changed the industry. If, you know, obviously the incident here we've gone over in great detail. I want to talk about why it's important and why when you watch it online, when you pull it up and watch this press conference, why it is so important for our world and our society that happened the way it did. And thank God Tony Caritsas didn't pull that trigger.
Yes.
Because it would have been a live execution nationwide.
Nationwide.
If you pull it up on YouTube, it's John Wayne accepting an award, and then there's an ABC special report, and it's Tony Caritsas in Indianapolis holding Dick Hall hostage, and it was a show for an hour.
Yes.
He did it for an hour. He sat there and talked and talked, and everybody just let him talk. But you can feel and you can see the tension in the room as it's happening. So these live cameras from the studios are in place. We're watching Tony Caritsas. And
the microphones, I don't even think we had an official microphone stand, but people, basically Tony was surrounded. I mean, the cops were standing right behind him. And what we didn't know at the time is Joe McAtee, who was with the Sheriff's Department, and Eugene Gallagher, who is the police chief, they had conspired to take Tony out if it got that far. And Gallagher had his 38 special in his pocket. and he was in plain clothes, and McAtee was in uniform. And at that moment, it was just a nod. McAtee was going to push the barrel away from Dick Hall's neck, the back of his head, and Gallagher was going to execute him at that point.
On live TV.
On live TV, yeah. But we didn't know this at the time.
Of
this,
course
this
so.
Came
yeah.
down months later.
Yeah, and part of the documentary, which we're going to just plug here, called Dead Man's Line. You can watch it on Amazon Prime. A guy, the director?
The creator of that was Alan Berry.
Alan Berry has the interviews with those people, and they literally say that he reaches into his pocket in the documentary three times to pull the handkerchief out as the signal that this was going to go down, and three times he put it back.
Yeah.
And for good reason, because later on, Tony Curtis gave himself up.
Right. And the other important thing, you said it changed the media. It did. Because, okay, sitting back, you had, four news directors, but primarily three news directors. At the time, you had Channel 4, then Channel 6, Channel 8, and Channel 13. They were the network stations. So 4, because it was all film, we didn't have the capability for live. Well, we had it for live TV, but they didn't employ it because Channel 4 actually had a new remote truck at that time because they had the contract for IU basketball. And then IU football. So they had the resources, but they didn't roll it out for that. We just depended on I'd shoot the film, take it back, and we would look at it, and then cut it and put it on the air. But where this changed was you had this live situation on TV. And
who's watching it?
Whoever, depending on their local station.
No, but I'm saying Tony Caritsis.
Oh.
He's watching it.
He's got the cameras, he got the lights there, but he wasn't really aware of...
Like any live reports that were coming in from the scene as he's holding him hostage in his apartment.
Oh, yes.
He has
yes.
the TV on and he's watching live reports,
right.
Which is not an uncommon practice today for situations similar.
Right. And this is where Dick DeMars came in as the deputy prosecutor. He was feeding Tony a line knowing that he was watching all the TV, saying, oh, no, just give yourself up. Everything's okay. We'll talk about it. Yes, we were in a position where they were using us as a tool as part of their negotiations. And at the same time, they said, don't say anything that would rile him up because he's very explosive and we don't want him getting mad at one of you because something you say. So as a media, we had a role to play during this negotiating holding process. So then on the final evening, when he finally gave himself up, they were live. Out of the three stations that were live, Channel 8, our proud sponsor for a couple of years, Channel 8 was the only one that stayed with it. Channel 13 would cut in and out, and then they would give the disclaimer, because of this volatile situation, we were afraid that he might get shot alive on TV. So we don't want you to see that. Channel 6, as I recall, dropped out. Now, I wasn't watching on TV. This is all later on. I was told what the reactions were. But the key was that Lee Giles, news director at Channel 8, decided to stay with it. And Lee said, yeah, we're taking a chance. But the other thing was, at that time, the FCC started cracking down and said, there are 7 words you can't say on the air. Well, Tony was using all of them.
He really
okay.
was.
Yeah. So it was like, oh, darn, he just said...
MF.
Yeah. That wasn't even in his language. But there were 7 words that actually George Carlin, the comedian, pointed out that you can't say on the air anymore. And Tony was using most of them. With that in mind, fortunately, it was resolved very good. Well, Lee then wound up doing a number of conferences and became like an authority because he stuck with it. And everybody's question was, why did you take a chance of seeing somebody committed or shot live?
Executed.
Executed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he had, because he was a true newsman, he said, that's what's going on. We're sticking with it. So there were parts of that news conference that people on Channel 6 and 13 didn't see, but it was all on Channel 8. So
Channel 8, Wish TV coming through.
Right. And I think that issue, and then a year later, in January, in the blizzard of 78, I'm kind of getting off track here.
No, you're okay.
But Stan Wood was the only one who was a, well, he was the meteorologist for Channel 4, or 8, longtime guy. But he studied the weather. He didn't really look at the maps and all the other meteorological stuff. He used woolly worms and things like that. He had a better feel for it. But he had been a meteorologist with the Air Force. And Stan said, we're going to have a blizzard. You need to, we need to get ready. We're going to have a blizzard for 2 or 3 days. We're going to have high winds, drop temperatures, and lots of snow. And everybody's going, oh, that's going to be another snowstorm. And Channel 8 at that time, they basically borrowed a SUV, a brand new SUV from a dealership. And that was their vehicle that they got around on. Okay. Down at Channel 4, we had a person in the production department that had a CJ7. I'm getting off the course here. Beth Ephraimson was with our production department. She and two other production people stayed over that night leading into the blizzard as it was things were developing. She had a CJ7 Jeep. She was the only four-wheel drive in all of the employees
well,
at
thank
Channel
God
4.
She had it during the thing of 78, the blizzard of 78.
Yeah, but because of those two incidents, even though I was at Channel 4, they set the tone for Channel 8 to be recognized as the news leader.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And it took the other stations, primarily Channel 13, a number of years and incidents going on to then be recognized as one of the news leaders in Indianapolis.
It's a way, you know, even to this day how do we handle situations? How do we handle live situations? It's not an easy call, and Lee Giles made the call.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with Lee, and I think many of us do now, and I can understand the other news directors pulling the feed because they don't want to subject the viewers to that, and it's more social. But from a journalistic point of view, and in a world of fake news,
yes,
right, that is the most real that you can get. And unfortunately, if it happened, it was going to happen. And you'd rather know and see it how it is than to have someone telephone style through a reporter tell you what happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And stepping back, if the gunshot had gone off, you wouldn't have known for a while what actually happened. You might have seen something, but I mean, they were ready to pull the plug on it as well. So fortunately, it
there's no 5 second delay in that world.
No. That was a thought, but it wasn't a reality at the time. Now, on my part, my news director, Jim Lockwood, called me and said, "You see what I see on TV?" I said, "Yeah, Jim. I live in Southport. It's going to take me 25 or 30 minutes to get out there." And he says, "Get dressed and get out there as quick as you can."
Oh, so you did go?
Yes, I did.
Did you get in there?
Because
it was an hour long. So.
Right, right. By the time I got there, and the buffer that I had was we had a very young photographer, Calvin O'Neill, mm-hmm. that lived right near the airport. So I said, call Calvin and send Calvin out there because it's going to take me a little bit longer to get there. He says, okay, go. So I get there, and I try to go in, and it took me about 25 minutes. And I tried to go in, and the sheriff stopped me. He said, you can't go in. Okay. And I said, but you know, all the other media is there. He said, no, you can't go in. So I said, okay, typical situation. So being a young newsman that I was, would not take no for an answer. So I drove about half a block around out of his sight, parked the car, grabbed my camera, and ran between the buildings. As I was coming around...
You sneaky SOB.
As I was coming around the adjacent wing of that building, Tony had given himself up by this time. They had taken him into one of the room they were using as a command post. And he finally, as part of that, was to unwire and hand them the shotgun. And Tony says, I got one request. I want to show you that I wasn't messing around. He steps outside the door and fires the shotgun.
Yes.
That happened as I was coming around the corner of the building and I hit the dirt.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
My gosh. And he did, and he wasn't fooling around, and the system that he had set up, it was as close to a dead man's trigger as you can make. Again, dead man's trigger, it means that, this is a little late to explain this, but it means that if Tony was killed, then immediately that Dick Hall would have been shot and killed. So don't kill Tony.
Right. You know? Yeah, he had it all wired where they were. You know. And his concern all along was being taken out by a SWAT team somewhere.
Yeah, sniper.
Yeah, and that's why, of course, it was February, so it's dark by 5 or 5:30. That's why he didn't come out of his apartment until like 5:30 or so, and walked across. He just sort of walked in and said, okay, here I am. Let's resolve this thing. So,
wow.
And then you're going, was he really crazy, or was he aware of what was going on? So, again, everybody was really flying by the seat of their pants here.
Unbelievable. If you have an opportunity, watch the documentary, Dead Man's Line. I got a chance to watch it because it's finally on Amazon Prime. I'm working on an interview with Andy. I mean, Andy.
Alan?
Alan. Sorry, Alan. Yeah, I'm working on an interview with Alan. I'm working on an interview with Alan soon.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll get some more footage. He's offering me some exclusive sound to use for the podcast. So that'll be really interesting.
Alan is great at research. He had actually only done one documentary before that, and he did it on Mayor Ballard, and which a lot of people took note on. And go, well, who's this guy that produced this thing? And then maybe a year later, this became his new project. Now, Alan was still working. He just wasn't a professional film editor, producer, whatever. He contacts me and says, I understand you're the guy I need to talk to about Tony Caritsis. I said, well, sure. Okay, I'll talk with you. And I gave him a copy of my contest piece that I had. The original video or film was at Channel 4, but in 1986, they closed down the news department at that time. This is the original Channel 4 with Cowboy Bob and Janie, Sammy Terry, and a small news department. They closed it down in 1986 and tossed all of that stuff, the Blizzard film, everything into the dumpster. So I have the only copy of it, and
maybe the Marion County Sheriff. We determine that, or Marion County Prosecutor.
Right. Well, and actually, Alan had looked it up. When you type in Tony Caritsis, it pops up on YouTube.
Yeah.
And that was the FBI copy, as far as we know,
awesome.
That had released it, put it on YouTube. So anyway, I met with Alan, gave him a copy of it, gave him my blessings. Because I figured since I got the only copy, I've got the only copyright, and I give him copyright to use it. And then I worked with him for over a course of a month. In the interview, we talked about basically doing the same thing, as kind of reliving that day. And I gave him a number of names of key reporters that were there that day. Well, in my estimation, from what I knew, there were about 12 or maybe 15 of us that were there, that were around for the.
Well, your memory is so on point. No wonder he used a lot of those names.
Well, yeah, and he went on to find another 40 people for his documentary. I mean, he dug in, and he had like other deputy prosecutors, the defense attorneys, and in doing this, he brought out a lot. So basically, my involvement with Tony Caritsis was that particular 20-minute episode, and then a couple of days later, getting there after the news conference. But there were a lot more people involved in this whole thing. Again, it changed the complex of how Indianapolis deals with this sort of thing. It put Indianapolis onto the national stage, or actually international stage, because of this incident. And
the land of Indians. That's what Indianapolis means. The land of Indians.
So and
actually the city of the land of Indians is Indianapolis. Indiana is the land of Indians.
Right. And I can't remember the exact time scale either after that, since this was in early February. It was at least another year before the trial and everything. But the legislature determined that we need to do something with that law, that you can be not guilty by reason of insanity, but that doesn't mean we should put you back out on the street. So they changed the law to basically incarcerate you. If you want to take that ploy in court, then you're going to pay the consequences. You're not going to get off scot-free.
That's right. That's right. A lesson to be learned on many fronts. Tony Kuritz's case, 1977 February. We're coming up on 43 years.
Wow.
And, dude, your memory is spot on. I'm honored, Jack. I'm so excited that you're my friend. We might have you on again. You have some other info.
Well, as
you've covered other cases as a photographer.
Yes, as chief photographer for Channel 4, I had a better than 50% chance, since we only had two photographers, that I was going to be involved in whatever it was. And yeah, we can go down a whole list.
Let me ask you a couple of big ones, and you could just say yes or no. How about did you do anything with Jim Jones in 1978 when that happened?
No.
The Burger Chef murders?
Yes.
What about the Speedway bomber?
Yes.
How about Herb Baumeister in 1996?
Yes.
Okay. And that's pretty much the three big ones I wanted, four big ones I wanted to ask you, because that's the stuff that people are really interested in. We're gonna come back. We'll talk a little bit later. As you just heard, we have a little bit more to go over. But, Jack, thanks. How was that? That was a good podcast, right? We did okay?
Yeah, that was good. That's my first podcast. I've listened to others, but I never even thought about being on a podcast. So, yeah, this is terrific.
I met you 4.5 years ago when you walked into the newsroom, and my friend Marcus Collins says, that's Jack Parker. I was like, oh, okay, Jack Parker. I mean, everybody talks about you at the station, so I didn't realize that you were here. And then the fact that you're my neighbor. I mean, literally, I ride my bike to your house. I could do it. So, unbelievable. Thank you so much. At the end of every podcast, I tell I like to invite my guests to say my slogan for the end, which is just stay safe, but you can do it in your own way. And I'd love for you to do it for me to end it.
Okay, well, stay safe.
That's one way to do it.
I can't. Stay safe and do it in your way.
I love it.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you.
You're amazing. All right, finally, thank you so much for listening to that insight. I'd love to have Jack on again real soon. He literally lives like a half a block away from me. Like, I'm not even kidding. Like, I can't believe he worked all that time with me in Indianapolis at Channel 8. You know, he was employed by Channel 8 while I was employed by Channel 8 in the news department. He worked there for so long. He had such a storied career, and it was truly my honor to talk to him and get a little bit of insight. Guys like that, those are the men that make the news happen. Yeah, anchors are pretty. Yeah, reporters are good. Yeah, they're interesting. They got things that are happening, and sometimes they bring you stuff that you wouldn't even think. They're the writers. But truly, truly, television news would not be anything without those photographers. And if you ask any reporter if you ask any reporter what they think about their photographers, it's always just pure love, because they're the ones out there shooting everything and getting it put together for them so that they can write it. Upcoming in the next couple of weeks, make sure to stay tuned. I'm going to have more interviews. I got a couple lined up. Like I said, I'm really, really impressed with Dead Man's Line, the documentary, and I'd love to get Alan Barry here on the podcast. So stay tuned. I'm trying my best to try to get him and one of his coworkers and co-producers to join us on this podcast. So with that, everybody, I just want to wish you all a happy 2020. I'd love to hear some resolutions. If you have some true crime resolutions, maybe you want to listen to 4 new true crime podcasts. I got a couple of recommendations for you. Big things happening this year, folks, and stay tuned with me and Wish TV, because we got a lot of things coming, including a new podcast at Wish TV that I'm helping produce, and I'd love for y'all to give it a shot and listen to it. If you like Indiana, Wish TV is going to have you covered, and not just in the news sense, but kind of lifestyle and current events and entertainment. We're gonna really bring it all on our new podcast. So stay. Thank you. As always, I'm Joe Mullillo, and stay safe.